Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alison Lurie. Lurie is a graduate of Radcliffe College and an emerita professor of American literature at Cornell University. She is the author of 10 books of fiction, 4 works of nonfiction, and 3 collections of tales for children. Her novel Foreign Affairs won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1985. Her new book, which we'll be discussing on today's show, is a collection of essays called Words and Worlds, From Autobiography to Zippers. It's due out shortly from Delphinium Books. And I welcome you to the show, Alison. Nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
Now, the first essay called Nobody Asked You to Write a Novel. And you talk about your physical challenges and your birth injuries, but that you knew you were clever. To tell us that, that's quite self-awareness.
Well, I didn't know I was clever for quite a while, and I realize now that my parents didn't know this, and I realize how worried they must have been when they were delivered a baby that had been damaged in the process of birth. My mother was 33, which is old for that period.
Yeah.
So it must have been a great relief for them when I actually began to walk and talk and do all the things that kids do. I don't think that they thought I was particularly smart until I went to, I was 4, and I learned to read. And it never seemed to me difficult. I remember my mother giving me a book about a mother bear and a baby bear, and somehow I got the idea very rapidly. So then I think she must have said, it's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And it was all right, but also in a way it wasn't all right, because in this country, and I think in many countries in the world, maybe all the countries in the world, it's very important for a little girl and a bigger girl and a woman to be beautiful and perfect.
Mm. Yes, people do expect that still.
They do.
Now, you talked about how you loved making up stories and it was fun for you as a child. To tell us about that, you also said that with pencil and paper, I could revise the world. To tell us your feelings about that.
Well, I realized, of course, that's a nice way of putting it. I could also revise the world by lying. I learned quite early that this was not the right thing to do. But, you know, most kids have made up stories to explain why they didn't do their homework or why they were late coming home. The trouble with me is my stories were so elaborate that no one would have believed them for an instant.
Wow.
I realize now that if I were to tell you that I was late to this appointment because there was an explosion on the street outside and fish were falling from the sky, the fish would be a mistake.
Yes, you're absolutely
you
right.
Might pass, but I had so much fun making things up. It was hard for me to keep it low-key and believable.
Well, you certainly learned how to do that. I like the statement that you said that writing was a kind of witch's spell. Tell us about that. So you feel like writing mesmerizes.
If it's good. I mean, you don't get it right all the time. But for some people, and sometimes you will get it right, and someone will come up to you and say, oh, I read what you wrote about, I don't know, even zippers. And it made a big difference in my life. And I realized that it wasn't just me that felt this. When I wrote an article about the language of deconstruction, which is a form of literary criticism very common in universities these days, perhaps less than it was, thank goodness. And I realized that the language they were using was very hostile to literature. It used to be that you read a book. Now you interrogate a text.
Mm.
If you interrogate someone or something, the assumption is that they've committed a crime. And the whole language of deconstruction, instead of building a novel out of characters and setting and plot, you construct it. So it's a building. It's a big hunk of stuff. Then you deconstruct it. You take it apart. The whole thing, when you're confronted, and that's another of their words, with a text, your job is to take it apart, not to appreciate it or explain it or talk about it and compare it to other books. No, your job is to interrogate it and take it apart. So I wrote about this. I got a lot of angry feedback, but I also got some very appreciative letters.
How do you feel about people deconstructing your work?
Well, you know, I'm not a highbrow author, so I've been lucky in that way. I haven't been deconstructed very often, or at least not as far as I know. I once ran into a professor whom I learned, because we had students in common, that this professor was going to teach a course in the contemporary American novel. I learned from the student that one of my books was on the syllabus. So I went to this person, who was much junior to me and new to the university, and I said, you know, I see that you're going to teach my novel. I wonder, would you like me to come in and talk to the class? She said, oh, no, that won't be necessary.
Wow.
Because if you're really a way out follower of deconstruction, you believe that the author is irrelevant. They just express the spirit of the age, which usually is wrong.
Wow. Oh, God, that's a way to eradicate.
But they don't pay much attention to the author and the author's life. Now, there's some people, there's a good side to this, because there are also, if you're a famous writer, people will be snuffling around after you and trying to find out who you slept with last night and, you know, what your political views are, and it can become very intrusive. So some writers have said to me, well, I love deconstruction because they don't want to know anything about me.
Ah.
So, you know, you win some, you lose some.
Yeah. Now, you know what? One of the essays in your book is, you write about your years at Radcliffe and some of the sexism you encountered. Tell us about that. What was that like?
Well, it didn't feel like sexism. You see, you don't see things that are so big and fill the available space. Today, for instance, there are people who feel that eating animals is wrong, and that a day will come when people will say to each other, how could they have done that? Mm. How could hundreds, millions of people killed these beautiful cows and sheep and eaten them? And it was the same way on a much lower and less dramatic scale with sexism. That was just the way things were.
Mm-hmm.
You were brought up with it. When I was growing up, middle-class women stayed home with their children. And women who worked were usually unmarried. Not always, but in when I think of my school teachers, yes. And that was just how it was. So I don't know, if the air is green everywhere, or pink or blue, then you think that's how it is.
Yeah. But did you have trouble being taken seriously, though? Because you obviously became a serious novelist, a well-known award-winner.
Well, things got better as time went on. I mean, women have always been allowed to write novels. They don't usually manage to write novels that get into literature.
Mm.
If you look at histories of English literature and American literature, there are practically no women writers.
Mm.
But people read their books. You can have readers, you can have editors, you can have publishers, you can have reviewers. You just aren't taking that seriously.
Yeah.
Even today.
Yeah, I know. You know, I thought it was interesting when you said that you had been married for 14 years before you published your first novel. What moved you to be able to do that? How did you find the time?
Well, first of all, I didn't have the time because I was working to put my husband through graduate school. As that was very, very common.
Mm-hmm.
You put your husband through graduate school or medical school or law school or whatever. And then you started to have babies and stayed home with babies. And in my generation, the average number of babies people had was three.
Mm-hmm.
Two was okay. If one was very sad, four was perfectly okay. And several of my friends had five or more, you know. And that was just, it wasn't thought that this was a mistake. Of course, it was very, very hard to get an abortion then.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Some people probably had maybe more babies than they would have wanted.
But
then after you got finished with the babies, then you were allowed to look around and take up some profession. And people became social workers or...
teachers.
Or teachers or bank executives, you know, or nurses or even doctors or lawyers. That was, by that time, it was just fine to take up a career. I was very lucky to have been born at a time when there was no pressure on women with babies to work. I think it's just terrible today that women with really small children are forced or feel they must force themselves to go out into the world and work and leave these kids with somebody who doesn't care as much about them as they do.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering, though, during those years when you first got married and started having kids, did you long to write? And did you feel like you had to wait?
I wrote all the time, but I didn't have as much time at first. But then when my youngest child went to nursery school, I had more time. And I did what many women did. I developed what I called playpen pals. They were other women who had children of the same name, who went to the same nursery school, and I had a very good friend here in town, and we would alternate every day, either two or three times a week, depending whose week it was. We would pick up both our child and the other child, take them home, feed them lunch, put them down for a nap. That meant that the woman whose turn it was could take their child to nursery school at 9 and be completely free until 3 in the afternoon when she'd go over to the friend's house and they'd have tea and the kids would play together and then she'd go home and cook supper.
Yeah.
So I suddenly had a lot of free time.
You were creative in how you found that time. Now, you know, I want to talk about the fact that you have a whole essay about how women adopted new names or didn't when they would get married in the era when you were a younger woman. To tell us about that. You talk about Judy Chicago. She took the city where she was born.
Yes, I mean, there were lots of choices. Some people took the name of the month in which they were born. If it was nice, if it was euphonious, like March, April, May, June. I don't know of anybody who called herself Mary November, but maybe there was, you know. Or you could just choose something you liked, like you could name yourself Anne Maple, or, you know, I'm just making that up. There's no such person as far as I know.
Yeah. But you didn't adopt a different name. You kept your birth name. You didn't change to your husband's names?
No, because my first husband's name was Bishop. There were already a lot of people named Bishop, writers named Bishop. Here in Ithaca, there was Morris Bishop, you know, who was a famous professor. Elizabeth Bishop.
Yeah, the famous poet,
The famous poet. And there were several others. And this name didn't feel like mine. And I knew that it wouldn't give my husband any pleasure to have me publish under the name Bishop. Because he was the one who was supposed to publish under the name Bishop. But my parents would be absolutely delighted, and they were.
That you kept your name?
That I kept my name.
Yeah, I think that was pretty daring in that era.
I don't know. I mean, several of my friends did and several didn't. I think it partly depends on whether they liked their original name.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alison Lurie. We're talking about her new collection of essays due out next month called Words and Worlds, From Autobiography to Zippers. I love this collection, by the way.
Thank you.
It's so fun to hear about what you think about things and some of the stuff about your early life. Mm-hmm. Now, to talk about your essay on witches old and new, I found that fascinating. Always been fascinated by witches.
Yes.
To tell us what caught your imagination in that.
Well, I think, of course, I knew about witches from childhood and from fairy tales, but it wasn't until I was grown up and in college that I realized that there actually still were practicing witches.
Mm.
There's some here, and even in Ithaca, but they're more likely to call themselves pagans, at least publicly. I know that there is a coven or two in Tompkins County even now, but they're very low-key, mm-hmm. and they think of themselves as spiritual and nature-worshipping rather than as witches. In Great Britain, they're nearer to the tradition. And I once wrote an article for the London Times, I think it was, and I went around with a photographer and visited a lot of practicing witches, and they came in all types. I mean, some were women who lived in villages and brewed potions, and others were rather glamorous urban types who liked to dress up in capes and tall hats and dance around a fire, sometimes with not very much on. So, you know, it appeals to different people in different ways. And I think there are also serious witches, people who really do follow what they think of as a very old pagan tradition. And I admire and respect that. I think I think it should be encouraged. I know that in Auburn Prison, even now, there is a coven of prisoners, and they have a minister, a witch, who comes to meet with them and conduct services once, I don't know if it's every week, but certainly very often.
Wow. Wow, yeah, I know witches. I mean, people believe in witches in every society in this world, it
seems.
They do.
And yeah. I think there are women who have some kind of special power. For instance, you.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, no, because you choose who you'll interview, and you shape the world. Because you present the world.
Hmm.
I don't know, have you ever had a witch on your program or a pagan?
You know, I don't think so. Not a self-identified one, but that's an interesting idea.
You might look into it, because they're very nice. I've been to several of their meetings here in Tompkins County. They tend to have their festivals on the quarter days, that is, on the spring and fall solstice and the winter and the summer solstice. And I remember particularly we went to the winter solstice, in which they had a bonfire and people wrote on slips of paper what it was about themselves or their lives that they wanted to get rid of as the pagan year was ending, which it ends not on December 31st, but on December 21st, the darkest day of the year.
Uh-huh.
So we all walked around the bonfire and tossed in these slips of paper, which had things written on them like my bad temper, maybe, or I don't know, turnips.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, people get preoccupied with
not
the strangest
turnips.
Things.
Well, if you were a man whose wife served turnips, it might be turnips.
It certainly could be. Now, I wanted you write a lot in this new book of essays about some of your friendships. Talk about Barbara Epstein, the co-editor of the New York Review of Books. Tell us about her.
Well, she was a friend of mine from college. She was 2 years younger than me, and I met her when she was a freshman and a commuter in the lunchroom. And she was very, very young. She was 16.
Mm.
And she was so smart. She had absolutely no advantages. She didn't, like me, come from an upper-middle-class intellectual family. But she was just naturally brilliant. And she was also incredibly modest. She became one of the most brilliant editors of a magazine that I've ever seen.
Mm.
But she never talked about anything. The gossip she knew would make anyone's hairs stand on end, but she was very, very reluctant to tell you anything about anybody. Once in a while, she would break down and tell me a story, and it was always amazing what she knew about famous literary figures and their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Did she help you with your own writing?
Yes, she was a wonderful editor, and she was so tactful. She never made me feel, why did I write this stupid sentence? She would just say, maybe it would be better, you know, or
To have try you something
of,
else.
You know, uh-huh. And in between these statements, which could be an ordinary person would say, how could you have said this dumb thing? Or you've repeated the word light 3 times in 2 sentences. No, she would say, oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful metaphor. Oh, I laugh so loud here. And she made you feel so good that the criticism just snuck in and washed all the faults away without your noticing it.
Yeah. Well, she must have really admired writers, too. I mean, that makes a
she
difference.
Did.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
She loved it. She read so much.
Yeah. To tell us about Edward Gorey.
Yeah.
He was one of your best friends.
He was, yeah. And he was the first real eccentric I think I ever knew in my own generation. Of course, most people don't become eccentrics until they're older. But he was perhaps a little unique person at the age of, I guess he must have been 20 when I met him, 20, 21.
Wow.
But he wasn't like anybody else. But it was restful. It was also, of course, he wasn't heterosexual. He also wasn't very homosexual. I don't think he probably ever had a relationship or nothing to speak of. But it was such a relief when you're at an age in which all the guys you know are really kind of after one thing or two or three things.
Yeah.
And he had he was like a friend. He was the first man I knew who was nothing but a friend.
Yeah.
And it was, and yet he was a guy. He'd been in the army. He knew about things that guys know about. So, and he was so funny and so charming and amazing, and so gifted too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's nice that he was comfortable enough to become friends with women, right?
Oh,
in
yes,
that
he
era.
He had many women friends. Barbara Epstein was a friend of his later on in New York. They, for a while, they were co-editors of a little paperback company that put out that reprinted old children's books,
uh-huh.
called the Looking Glass Library.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you moved to this era. Tell us about Harry Potter. Tell us about J.K. Rowling. You're fascinated by the success of this.
Well, it was amazing.
Series.
They're very good books. They're very inventive. She isn't just turning them out the way some writers' series do. The last book is just as good as the first one. You can feel that she's completely involved in it. I mean, the kind of success she's had is awfully hard to live with, I think.
Oh, yeah. You talk about how fame can trap people, and she seems like a prime example of being trapped by all these people coming after her.
Yeah, if you become really famous, you attract enemies as well as friends.
Mm.
I've never been that famous. I haven't attracted enemies. I've made friends, and that's wonderful. But if you become really famous, it's a certain amount of weird people will get into your life or try to get into your life, because this is a way they can become famous. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's much worse for guys, because a man who becomes famous, all of a sudden, there's a lot of women who want to sleep with him, and some of them are very flaky. I'm reading now a biography of Saul Bellow,
uh-huh.
and the after he won the Nobel Prize, it was just scary how women kept turning up in his life and literally on his doorstep, you know?
Because yeah.
Their life had no meaning, but if they became the girlfriend of Saul Bellow or his wife, then it would have meaning, you know?
Yeah.
Or that's how it
And that's what
how
they
it
think.
To them.
Yeah.
It was bad for his ego and very annoying for the people who actually were his wife. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And that has not changed at all. Fame is still something that people are constantly running after, right?
Yes, I think so. I mean, people want to be famous now. Didn't more than they used to. I mean, it used to be people wanted to be successful in a moderate way. They wanted to have a nice house and friends and a job they loved, but they didn't feel they had to be famous.
Uh-huh.
But now I think it's social media that people are counting their followers. That's one reason I don't have any of those things like Facebook. I wouldn't want to. I don't know if I would be strong enough not to look to see if I had any news followers on Tuesday, you know.
Yeah. Mm. You know, Allison, we're almost out of time. Can you just tell me really briefly, what is it about fashion that has so taken your imagination? You've written books about it. You wrote an essay about it. To tell us real quickly.
I don't
quickly.
Really know. I've always been interested in clothes. My mother was interested in clothes. She used to make doll clothes for my sisters and my dolls. And she was very aware of what we were wearing, and she would take us shopping, and she would say, "No, that doesn't look right on you. That's not a good color for you." She dressed well, but very, very low key. I don't know you. How can you say what interests me? I think partly because I'm interested in art. I mm-hmm. love to go to museums. I'm interested in the way things look. Whereas mm-hmm. some people, like my husband, are interested in the way things sound, mm-hmm. in music, in voices. We'll go for a walk, and I'll say, "Oh, look at that magnolia." And he'll say, "Listen to the crickets."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, great combination. Well, we're out of time. Can you give contact information, website, anything you want people to get in touch with you via?
People can always write me, care of Cornell English Department.
Yeah, yeah.
And those letters eventually will reach me. I don't go in and collect my mail all the time, but every few weeks I do.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us, Allison. This has been a great pleasure. The book is called Words and Worlds, From Autobiography to Zippers, and it's due out very soon from Allison Lurie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.